if we don't even have a game plan or we don't even know what it's going to take to get there, that's when you don't have a lot of hope. I have an enormous amount of hope because we know much more now about PSP than we ever have before. We have incredible tools to do this kind of work that I'm describing that was completely unattainable 10 years ago.
So much remains unknown in the progression of rare diseases like PSP, CBD, and MSA. Looking under a microscope reveals patterns of an unsolved puzzle. Compared to dementias like Alzheimer's disease, where abnormal proteins define a clear disease and mutate genes in a predictable way, PSP affects a different region of the brain, leading to different symptoms and an altered tau protein, which mutates genes in a way that scientists are still trying to understand. Dr. Jessica Rezac and her team at UCLA have been scouring sequencing data from over 10,000 individuals, searching for clues in the DNA that could explain how changes in the immune system might influence why some individuals develop these conditions. They want to find out which genetic factors are common to both diseases and which are unique to each. Identifying these patterns would be a massive step forward in understanding the causal factors of PSP and a potential site for immune-based therapies. For this episode of The Collective Mind, Dr. Rezac spoke to me about her project that is piecing together a picture of the altered messengers of the immune system, which hopes to make these diseases much less mysterious. The project is supported by CurePSP's Pathway Grant Program, which provides seed funding to support projects studying the fundamental neurobiology of PSP and CBD.
So I'm a neurologist and a scientist. So I do see patients with PSP and Alzheimer's disease and a bunch of other disorders. And I have subspecialized in my clinical practice in two ways. I've subspecialized in neurogenetics and in behavioral neurology. So what that means is that I think very much when I see patients about cause at the molecular level of what's going on from the perspective of the human genome. So humans, you know, we've evolved. We're actually a species that compared to a lot of the other species on the planet is one of the youngest species. But we do have variation in our genome that contributes to, you know, why I'm different than you or the next person. But that variation can also influence our risk for having diseases. And one of the challenges with neurodegenerative diseases or adult onset diseases in particular is that, you know, they kind of start all of a sudden and then get worse over a period of time. And it's hard to figure out where the starting point is for causal mechanism in the trajectory of that individual's life, right? The disease kind of creeps in when you're asking about, you know, when, oh, I had a little bit of this and then a little bit of this. So it's very hard to kind of try to tease out causality in that way. But when you can study the genetic background of a person or groups of people compared to people who don't get the disease, you can tease out these kind of molecular posts that give you an idea of what some of the pathways and variation are in how cells work to begin with. That could already start to influence disease down the road. And you can get what we like to call like a causal anchor. So you have the chance to actually rationally think about how do we get from being okay to having this disease? You know, what are the real mechanisms? Where could we think about shifting that trajectory? So does that make sense, or can I break that down anymore for you?
Yeah, so that's a good start.
So you asked about Alzheimer's versus progressive supranuclear palsy. So I can address that from this perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Alzheimer's disease is a degenerative disease that affects certain parts of the brain, kind of tends to happen at a point in life, and progresses in a certain way. And when you look under the microscope, there's a couple of abnormal proteins that are very characteristic of Alzheimer's disease. So when you put all of those kind of four things together, where in the brain is the disease happening? What kind of phase in life? those couple of proteins you can see under the microscope, you can begin to define like a really specific disease that is happening to people, you know, all the time. And what's interesting is that when you then look at the genetics of those group of people, they also have matching characteristics. Mm-hmm. So Alzheimer's disease patients have a memory problem. Well, because the memory part of the brain is the part that's affected first and most affected as the disease progresses. You know, Alzheimer's disease at the molecular level is from these proteins tau and beta amyloid. Those were the things you can look at under the microscope. Why? Well, we don't know entirely why we see those in those patients, but we do understand that there are very rare cases where there's mutations in some of those genes that could be contributing factors. So we think it has something to do with the causal mechanism. Contrast that with PSP. Let's think about those same factors, right? The where, the when, etc. And we see that like Alzheimer's disease, cells seem to be getting sick. They seem to be losing their function, but it's happening in a different part of the nervous system. It's happening more in the subcortical regions that affect movement, eye movement, those types of functions, which are otherwise, you know, not part of the Alzheimer's disease picture. And also include some of the front of the brain regions that impair thinking that are also affected in Alzheimer's disease, but it affects them in a slightly different way. It's hitting different cells and it's affecting those cells slightly differently than in Alzheimer's disease. So there's actually something in the brain happening in a different place. And that correlates to why patients present with different symptoms. Add that extra layer of looking under the microscope. And in fact, the protein tau, which is seen abnormally in PSP, is a slightly different shape of tau than the kind you see in Alzheimer's disease. So even at the under the microscope level, there's a difference. And then finally, we talked about genetic makeup, right? So when we look at the genetic makeup of people who have risk of Alzheimer's disease, we see a certain pattern. When you look in progressive supranuclear palsy, it's a very different pattern. So that suggests that the actual causal pressures in the cell level that, you know, when met with disease kind of give way and contribute to disease progression, to clinical disease, those causal factors are actually also different for PSP. So in those ways, they're very different disorders.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you hurt the brain, you hurt brain cells, things start to happen in a very reproducible way. So there's also a lot of shared mechanism too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so thinking about causal factors that, you know, lead to symptoms and just disease progression, I'm wondering how is, like, just very basically, like, the process, how is the immune system connected to the health of our brains? Like, could you maybe just describe a little bit of what that's like from stuff that you see in the immune system to symptoms that people feel?
Absolutely. So this is a completely new horizon in brain science that there's a lot of fundamental questions that we still are asking. For a long time, it was thought that the immune system doesn't interact very much with the brain, which I guess is kind of naive because we know that it really does regulate infections and cell health throughout the body. So why would the brain be any different? But I think what's true from what we saw before is that the brain and the immune system interact with each other in a very different way, it seems, than the way the immune system interacts with cells in the rest of our body. And we know it's different. We know that there's a role for the immune system in the brain, but we don't know quite exactly what all of those components are. So it's an exciting time where there's a lot to be discovered. We know that so I'm going to go back to the discussion we were having before about genetics, okay? Mm-hmm. We know that genes vary from person to person, and that ultimately that contributes to our risk of getting diseases, particularly, you know, kind of later onset chronic diseases. And importantly, the immune genes are our most varied genes in the human genome. So they often get picked up on these comparative studies where we say, hey, let's map the genome of people who have Alzheimer's disease compared to people who don't. Or let's do that for Parkinson's disease, or let's do that for multiple sclerosis, or let's do that for cancer. There's a lot of studies like this. They're called GWAS studies, or they also do whole genome sequencing. There's just so many different ways we can do this now. And a lot of the times, there's a big, signpost sitting in the immune part of the genome. And we can see that in these studies over and over again. And sometimes it's a slightly different signal that's getting picked up. But that's not enough for us to really understand that signal. It just tells us that it's there. So it tells us the immune system and the way the immune system varies appears to have some causal contribution to the risk of these diseases. It's not black or white necessarily saying, oh, the immune system is the whole story. But we can imagine that the immune system, which really modifies sick cells in our body and regulates how sick cells are restored or cleared from the body, how variations in that could impact these diseases, right? We can easily imagine that that would not be an unreasonable expectation. But again, we don't know the details of how, particularly in the brain, and we see this signal in the immune part of the genetic signal that tells us that there's something there that we need to learn more about. Okay, so as we start to dig and as we've dug, particularly so far into Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease, we're really finding some interesting stuff implicating immune cells that play a role, again, in really cell and tissue surveillance, but also viral infection. And we're finding these absolutely new interactions that are open the field to questions like, well, can we boost the immune system or dampen certain aspects of the immune system as a possible therapeutic, which is very exciting because the immune system as a target for therapeutics has been revolutionizing cancer and autoimmune disease. So there's a lot that we can do there if we can just figure out how to translate that into these degenerative diseases. So we're thinking about this from the original contrast that I made in your first question about Alzheimer's disease versus progressive supranuclear palsy, where I said different parts of the brain are affected at slightly different times in our lives, and different proteins are sitting there, and the genetic different, right? Remember I said that. But we don't
The what is
know
different? I
if
cut
some of
out
this,
the
the
genetics.
genetics are different.
Okay.
Yeah. But we don't know how some of these, findings in the immune genetics that have been being made in Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's, we don't know if those are different or those are the same, because to understand that requires digging deeper into the data. So that's what we propose to do here, is start from the genetics perspective. It's called immunogenetics, and apply some specialized analytical techniques to existing data to understand whether the pattern in those regions suggests there may be a link with PSP, and whether there's a difference between the link seen in Alzheimer's disease and what we see in PSP, right? Because there's been more progress in this space in Alzheimer's disease, which has been kind of a leading edge. As you can imagine, there's been a lot of work, and the PSP now has a big genomic study that provides the opportunity to say, well, how does this compare?
Yeah, so you mentioned Alzheimer's, there being more known about it. I'm curious just to kind of get a scope of how much we know or don't know about PSP and atypical Parkinsonians. Like, how much would you say we know about, PSP versus compared to Alzheimer's or another dementia that's, obviously more popular and well known?
So we've done a recent really heavy lifting collaborative study with involved a lot of people that we're publishing that actually compares these disorders head to head in human brain tissue. And this was a study that profiled progressive supranuclear palsy versus Alzheimer's disease and another disease called Pick's disease, which is a kind of frontal temporal dementia that also has tau. And we did this in multiple ways, including single cell sequencing of gene expression, but also the way that genes are regulated. We profiled by single cell sequencing, looking at DNA structures. And we also looked across seven different brain regions that are all differentially affected by disease. So this was a big study. And in this study, we found that there are some very, very distinct differences between PSP and the other disorders. The first thing to say is that most of the changes we see in the brain actually are shared, suggesting that they're probably relating to like cells being injured or reacting to the general phenomenon of neurodegenerative, changes. But there's a few sets of changes that really separate out from the rest as being distinct by disorder, including some in the PSP space that we had no expectation of and need to be now scrutinized in more studies because this is brand new stuff, right? In science, when you make a new discovery, that's the beginning of then trying to replicate that broadly before you know if you have a truth. But what we found, for example, is that astrocytes, which are these really important support cells in the brain that help neurons function, they were actually looked to be injured or vulnerable or lost in the PSP brains in unexpected brain regions compared to the other disorders. We also saw some just fundamental changes involving the inflammatory response and also the way that neurons were signaling that were kind of brain-wide in PSP and reproduced some previous studies trends, but this was the first time we looked at enough brain regions to say confidently that it's not just a matter of like, you picked one spot and didn't see the same thing. We looked throughout the whole brain and we see that these are really happening differently throughout the whole brain in PSP patients. So we have some new observations to support thinking about differences in PSP at the molecular level. And it's helpful to do this where you're taking a common disorder and contrasting it with the atypicals or rare disorders, rarer. PSP is not that rare, but it is a rare disorder because it allows you to kind of do like a quick catch up and say, okay, well, we know all this stuff about Alzheimer's disease that's emerging. If we can kind of lift some of that reasoning over to the PSP space, can we kind of do a catch up with PSP? So that was part of this. But also, this study was again rooted in the genetics. So if we see that there's a different genetic predisposition to these different diseases, does that translate to actually different molecular changes that you could see under the microscope or in the brains? And if you can find an intersect between them, that might be kind of the where is causal disease happening in the human brain? So we did actually find some intersects that we're going to be following up on that might help us understand not just what is different in the PSP brain, but why is it different? So we're really excited about this work, and we're going to be taking this forward into the lab. The proposal that we put in for this Cure PSP is one complementary aspect of that. Because in order to do the why is what different question, we have to understand the genome. And there's been a beautiful project work recently to map the PSP genomic changes, but it just didn't take care of this immune portion that we're very interested in based on some of the findings that we had. So we're kind of taking the opportunity of this funding to fill that gap so that we can really comprehensively ask how could the immune part maybe describe or help us understand the differences that we see in the human brain tissues. And can we translate that more broadly into just broader differences that we see? Was that clear, or can I clarify anything on that?
Yeah, so you see the immune system is interacting and implicating the genome.
Yeah, well, the genome is at the heart of everything.
Okay.
And when you know that the genome starts off already different, and then you see differences at the molecular level that are reproduced over, 10, 15, 20 people, they group them all together and they all still have this one or two differences compared to Alzheimer's disease, you're going, okay, there's something really fundamental driving that, right? So when you see these differences reproducibly across people, it's something very fundamental that's causing that. It could be some acquired thing, like an environmental thing that we don't know, or it could be something from the genome, or it could be a combination. So you have to break it down and understand the parts to figure out how to build it back up again. And if you can do that, then you understand causality. So that's what we're making an effort to contribute to do, right? Piece by piece, there's a very clear roadmap in front of us. It's a very logical concept here of understanding causal mechanisms, understanding how cells differ in this disease, putting it all together and, you know, and making a logical framework in which to understand these diseases and how and where their key kind of trigger points are. It takes a lot of steps to execute that and to execute that in a way where you can really say you have something, because we're doing all of this work directly out of patient samples, right? So this is human research. You have to really do it with a lot of people before you're sure of what you have. But we're kind of working on that broader goal with this project is a key piece.
Yeah. This might be might be a dumb question, but can a genome be altered?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're working on that now. It's called gene therapy. It's called gene therapy.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah. Yeah, we definitely have some studies related to that.
But you know, in gene therapy, you're kind of making a single edit typically. The way I think about the way you want to think about the genomics here is that think about it maybe more like this. I'm going to try to parallel with this. So let's say that you've got a factory and you have factory workers and you're seeing that some people are having a hard time getting to work on time. And you don't know why. So you look at the people and you look at their genetics or you look at their traits, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you separate them out. And maybe you find that the people who are getting to work on time have some genetic variations at various spots in their genome, but it's making it so that they're, you know, 5 to 12 inches taller than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You go, whoa. Okay, the people who are coming to work late are taller than the people who are making it on time. And then you look at the factory and you go, wait, we have this door to get in that's actually really short. And maybe the tall people are having a hard time figuring out how to get their bodies through the door.
Yeah.
So the solution to that is not to chop their heads off, right? Which would be gene therapy. It's to get them through another way. It's to say, okay, let's make the door bigger, or let's give those people some kind of sled so that they can get through on their knees or whatever that might be, right? But there's going to be a lot of different solutions to how to get that group of people past their, you know, the trouble spot once you've defined it. That may not be, you know, just making the difference go away. So here, let's say that you found that people who have, you know, an immune variation that makes them more likely to tolerate certain kinds of abnormal proteins, right? That would be the kind of thing we might be able to find from a study like this. So, okay, so their immune system's working, but they're just, there's a certain part of the immune system that maybe is different than the people who don't have this. How does that match up with what we see in disease? Hey, look, in disease tissue, there's a protein that looks kind of like what their immune system can't recognize. Maybe we need to do something about that protein or give it the immune system a boost against that protein by giving it a vaccine or something like this, right? So there's, then you kind of start to solve the problem. But first you have to line up and figure out what is actually causing the problem. And if it was as easy as looking at everybody and figuring out who was tall and who was short, right?
Mm-hmm.
We would have done that already with PSP. But in the same way, we expect that there's probably variations in people that are contributing to whether or not they're going to get this disease. And if we can figure out how and where that intersects with their risk, then we can come up with great solutions for that problem. We already know that there is one really strong genetic component to PSP, which is a, you know, a way that our genome is arranged. If it's arranged a certain way around the tau gene, then the risk for PSP can increase by 4 or 5-fold. So we already know that. And there's already a lot of really incredible work going on to understand that. Some work going on in our lab to try to understand how that relates so that we can make a solution for that problem. So it's really strong to find these differences because, you know, then you can track them down, understand what they relate to, and start to solve those problems.
Yeah, so it almost seems like it's pre-intervention, like figuring out what you want to change. What would those, so we mentioned gene therapy as something like chopping off their heads. What would the types of interventions that you're mentioning, like what you mentioned, maybe vaccines, but yeah, what are some of the different things?
So for, you know, there's so many different kinds of treatments that are available now. Mm-hmm. You know, there's small molecules are still incredibly important, and there's been always new chemistry coming out and new strategies to manipulate, you know, cell machinery with small molecules. So I always think small molecules still, you know, a key kind of drug, a key kind of therapy. But particularly if you start to address things like the immune system, you can start to consider some of the newer alternative types of therapies like cell therapy, or, you know, immunomodulators like antibodies that change the way the immune cells function, or vaccines that change what the immune cells see or how they respond to those things, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it opens up more space. But just to be clear, you know, we're at the early days of just trying to figure out how the immune system may even be happening, may even be contributing here, which really needs to be answered because of how potentially important those questions could be. But until we answer those questions, I think we don't know yet where the opportunities are going to be.
Right. And you might have already answered this, but as you said, what do you hope answering those questions about the immune system, how would that influence treatment and care for patients?
Yeah. So I think, you know, we have to turn every leaf on the genomics to understand the risk factors going into disease so that we can take advantage of the incredible progress is being made in functional genomics and data science to translate those into new targets. Once we have targets, which means something in the disease space that we think that those genes are influencing, we can actually start to go after them and find out if there's therapies there. So this is the way that almost all progress is being made in neurodegenerative disease research right now, is by following genes. Mm. And that's because there's just so much that happens in these diseases that if you don't have some kind of anchor causally, it can be really hard to know, you know, that your change is going to be in the right way, is going to be in the right direction. Mm-hmm. If you have genetics to support your ideas, you can actually rationalize from the onset, this is going to be the right direction to change things to cause the right impact that I'm trying to make. So this is the way that these disorders are finally starting to see therapy. We see our first examples of therapies coming out just in the last years for diseases that previously had nothing, that are following mostly from this kind of logic. So we just need to complete that and then continue to understand at the molecular level what is happening in PSP so that we can begin to figure out which of those differences are key areas for therapies. And it sounds like an enormous amount of work to do, right? To get to a therapy. But I can tell you this, when you don't know how to articulate how to get there, that's where you want to be worried, right? Mm. If we don't even have a game plan, or we don't even know what it's going to take to get there, that's when you don't have a lot of hope. I have an enormous amount of hope because we know much more now about PSP than we ever have before. We know we have incredible tools to do this kind of work that I'm describing that was completely unattainable 10 years ago. And it is the right tools for this problem, and we know how to address it. So, you know, I'm articulating that there's, you know, a process that needs to be executed, but I have great confidence that we're going to get what we need out of these kinds of processes that are happening now and that this work is contributing to. So it's a very exciting time.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Very on brand as a pathway grant. Yeah. Sorry, I have two questions. So I guess I'll start. What is the population you mentioned you're looking at genomes of patients? Is that, mm-hmm. Yeah. So what has it been like gathering that population, and Yeah, because I know it can be tough sometimes to kind of for PSP to gather a population to study. So,
Yeah.
what is yours like?
Yeah, so well, we're standing on the shoulder of giants, and a lot of previous work that was enabled by Cure PSP and other consortia efforts to actually generate whole genome sequencing data set for PSP. So we're actually going to work with that data. We also have tools to take other kinds of data to do complementary analyses to expand our observations even further. But the real core of this is that whole genome sequencing that was completed in for PSP recently, and where the immune genes haven't undergone the analysis that we propose because it requires a special approach. The immune genes are like super packed together, super tight, and you have to run different algorithms to tease that apart that are not necessarily standard. And we also want to do this in comparison with Alzheimer's disease, because Alzheimer's disease whole genome data is, tenfold more people. So we're trying to see if we can translate some of the findings that have already gotten that discovery level from the bigger data sets in Alzheimer's disease and then just bring them into the PSP and say, do we see similar or not? So we have a couple strategies on that. But yeah, all of this is requiring that those cohorts are already existing. And it's an analysis-focused grant because that analysis alone takes a lot of work. And this is where community is so necessary. And this is where building incredible data sets is important because they live on. You make the data set, you do your primary analysis, and then you bring it into the hands of the next scientist who's going to do even more with it or do something different with it. So there's a real value in investing in making these high-quality data sets.
Yeah, how do patients and families, how do they influence your research and how can they help your research? Is there any ways they could engage with it?
So I actually consider my research part of my clinical job. I don't see myself as having two jobs, being a scientist and being a doctor, but it's more from the level of a real kind of a more of a perspective and a very personal level where I'm inspired by the observations I make from my patients. I'm inspired by what I see of their needs and what I see of their strength and their courage. And, we take that into everything that we do. I think that for translational science, I think translational science with these kind of disease focus, I think it's always the patients at the center. The samples that we're able to access are because a patient donated those samples. Here we're taking advantage of financial resources that were put together by patients and donors and people who are really driving this. So we're part of that. It's a community effort, but the patients and their families are at the core, and we need them to kind of drive the work,
Yeah, and kind of off that, something I'm thinking about, you interact with a lot of patients and at a time when there's not really any therapies for them, it feels like palliative care and kind of adjusting because the disease has changed so much so quickly, adjusting based on, what they're saying, it seems really important and important for, minimizing symptoms. So I'm just wondering, what do you see as the most effective treatments for something like PSP that lacks therapeutics?
that lacks therapeutics. I mean, everything lacks therapeutics, but it makes a huge difference whether somebody with a degenerative disease gets good care or not. It makes a huge difference. The priorities are twofold. Top of the priority list is quality of life. Second priority is maintaining or adjusting as needed to maintain functionality as best as possible, right? So even when you can't cure something, there's a heck of a lot you can do for both of those goals. And they can be incredibly important and will remain incredibly important, I think, in medicine. So it's palliative care because by definition, it's care that's not curing, but rather treating and healing, right? But that is at the center of, what we do. I had a patient with a different but related disorder come to me. In their case, it was not PSP, it was a genetic disorder that was running in their family. And for generations, the family just said, well, we got this. And when they'd start to get sick, they wouldn't really do very much about it. They felt like there was nothing that can be done. And she came in and was very proud of the fact that she was the first person from her family who said, no, I can do something to improve my quality of life and my function and my longevity. And she had, or attested to me, that her experience was completely different with the disease. And I think by the time I had met her, she had already outlived every other family member by a decade.
Wow.
So these things make a difference. You know, in different diseases, they make a difference more or less, right? Because some of the things we can adapt better for. There's a lot of challenges with PSP and being able to adapt to the particular way patients fall and can get injured. We have special walkers for that, but it still can be a real challenge, you know? And then with cognitive, there's very little that we can do, I have to say, honestly, to adapt when somebody's cognitive skills have been affected to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But we can still support with what we can do and offer not only that technical, whatever it is, DME or, medication to help with, bowel and bladder function or whatever that is. But we also can make the patients and families understand that we're with them and we're walking the journey with them and that they're cared for, you know? So I try to carry those things with me because almost universally, with very few exceptions, I can't treat any of my patients curatively for any of the things that they have.
Yeah. And I guess lastly, what do you hope that future studies could take from this? Where do you hope research goes from here?
Where do I hope research goes from here? I just hope we keep going, you know? I think we're at this point where where the investments from 10 years ago, 5 years ago are giving us completely new and exciting opportunities, and we have to just keep the pressure on. And especially when there's been, long, it can feel like from the outside, I think in particular, that we've gone on this long road and we're still not there, right? But, I can see that. I see that we're getting there. It's still a lot of work. We got to put our foot more on the gas and accelerate and push more research. Let the data drive the work and support not just incremental science, but really, science that's willing to go where it needs to go to have the impacts it needs to have for patients. All the tools are there, but science is, it takes time, it takes energy, it takes teams, it takes talent, and it takes a lot of resources, a lot of resources. And so I just want to see or encourage to keep going because I know we'll get there if we do.
Thank you to Dr. Jessica Rezac for the crash course on this cutting-edge immune system-based research. Projects like these have been sorely needed for PSP, CBD, and MSA, and I'm happy to give a peek into the laboratory. Look out for more research-based episodes in the future. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Oscar Sullivan. Thanks for listening, and talk to you soon.